Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, today we're going to spend our couple of hours zeroing in on Norway. And to begin, we're talking about a new book. It's titled Mission to Oslo, Dancing with the Queen, Deal Making with the Russians, Shaping History. And the author, Tom Loftus, is with us. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Norway. He served 14 years in our state legislature. It was four terms as Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, ran for governor at one point, and is from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. So as we talk with Tom, I hope you'll join in with your own questions, maybe about the role of an ambassador, and certainly about Norway. Maybe you visited the country. Let us know your questions and maybe experiences about Norway, or maybe about international diplomacy. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Tom Loftus, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me. I have to add that I'm a regular listener to your garden show.
Well, that's good. That is good to know, and I appreciate that. You've had your book, by the way. I really enjoyed your book. I'm a guy who kind of likes history, and I like behind the scenes kinds of things relating to history. I like a little humor. And I like to learn about a country. So all that came through in your book. So thanks for writing it to begin with. You must have had fun putting it together.
Well, yeah, 4 years to write the book and another year or two to finish it for publishing. But it was a delight to write. You are correct.
And I enjoyed right away in the beginning of the book, you talk about the materials you used to put your book together. Tell us about that.
Well, how does one write a memoir 30 years after the fact? Well, I left Norway and had 10 boxes of personal papers shipped home. I never opened them until 5 years ago. And lo and behold, there was my daily schedule, which is an hour-by-hour schedule, for all 1,461 days I was in Norway as the ambassador. So that raw material wasn't only the schedules. It was the guests, Jimmy Carter. It was the dinners, Tommy Thompson. It was the menus for the dinners. It was my travel schedule that when I reread the book before publication, I got tired. I really was on the road both in Norway and in Europe. So that's how it came about, that raw material just presented itself, and it was a joy to write.
Let's talk about the relationship between Wisconsin and Norway. We kind of influenced each other, I think, in some ways.
Well, in many ways, of course, we can start with the 800,000 Norwegian immigrants that came over a period of time, starting in 1825, and that was about 40% of the population of Norway. And they came to Wisconsin, Illinois, the Dakotas, and Minnesota. It was called a rural-to-rural immigration because they came from farms and they settled in farm communities. But the largest concentration of Norwegians, 50,000, was in Chicago, in the Humboldt Park area. And that was the largest concentration of Norwegians outside of Oslo and Bergen.
And
you have that as a starter, And then you have some little details that young Norwegian men were paid a bonus to come to Wisconsin to fight for the Union Army. And the Wisconsin division, headed by Hans Christian Hegg, was a very important part of the immigration story.
Yeah. And you have, obviously, familial ties to Norway. Maybe describe that for us.
Well, my grandfather, as a young boy, came with his family, nine children, left Telemark, Norway, came, and eventually ended up in Dane County, Wisconsin. They left on July 4th, 1885, and settled in the Oregon, Brooklyn, and Stoughton area eventually. I went to this farm in Telemark, and I knocked on the door, and sure enough, the people were named Lofthus. It was L-O-F-T-H-U-S. So my family name means loft house. In all, it means they left a farm that had a house that had a loft. So that name of the farm was very common for Norwegian immigrants. Now, the H was dropped when they got to America. And Telemark is sort of the... I'd say card playing, drink some once in a while, fiddle playing. It's we're almost pagan part of Norway. My grandmother came from the Stavanger area. This is the Bible Belt of Norway, and no card playing, no dancing, no fun, no nothing. How these two would have never met in Norway.
Oh.
And this is part of the American dream, of course, that there they are. And I inherited that Telemark part of the gene.
Oh, man. Well, I want to switch to ambassadors for a minute. How long has the U.S. had ambassadors stationed around the world?
Well, Ben Franklin was the first.
Yeah.
During the Revolutionary War, he was in Paris, and his job was to enlist the French on behalf of America against the British. Thomas Jefferson was a subsequent ambassador to France. And we have John Adams as an ambassador in the Netherlands. So it's been as long as we have been a country. Now, Norway has only been an independent country since 1905. So our ambassadors start then. And during World War One. Woodrow Wilson's ambassador was Alfred Schmiedren from Wisconsin, who later became the mayor of Madison and the governor of the state. That's a thumbnail sketch there.
And you've kind of implied some of the duties of an ambassador, but maybe you could talk about, you know, when you were an ambassador, what were the prime duties? And your prime duties, I'm sure, were quite in many respects, quite similar to the rest of the ambassadors.
Well, when you are an ambassador to a country, that means the president has nominated you and the Senate has voted on you, and you become an ambassador to a country. And you're called an ambassador plenipotentiary, which means that you can act on behalf of the president. Yes, the State Department is the superstructure, and that's where most of the business is. But it's quite an important job, and the American ambassador in any country is the main person. Of the diplomatic corps, And I had an occasion to act on behalf of the president without his knowledge. The Nobel Peace Prize is given in Oslo. And one day I am waiting in my office to go to the city hall for the Peace Prize ceremony for Nelson Mandela. And an hour before, I get a phone call. My assistant says, I think you'll want to take this call. And it was Nelson Mandela. And he said, thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for taking my call. Could you be in my hotel suite, the Grand Hotel, 1 hour after the Nobel Prize ceremony? And I said, of course. Now, I had not a clue what this was about. Well, I was there. I go into the room, and honest to goodness, there is an aura. There is almost a goodness in the air. And we shake hands. His hands are very soft. He pours me tea, and I take milk, and he takes milk. Well, this is about a tariff issue, that the United States is proposing a tariff at some negotiations at this time for South Africa. And Mandela will be the new president of the new South Africa in about 6 months' time. And he said, if this U.S. tariff that you're proposing goes through, I'll lose 200,000 jobs in the textile, which is basically the clothing. So here is the plenipotentiary part. There's a secret number for ambassadors, and it's a special White House operator. So I call and I said, I need the trade negotiator on the phone within 10 minutes if possible. And I knew him. His name was Mickey Cantor. So he gets on the phone and I say, Mickey, I'm in the hotel suite in Oslo with Nelson Mandela. He has just received the Nobel Peace Prize, and he wants us to change our position on tariffs. And I said we would. Here, I'll put him on the phone. Well, okay, so Mickey said, well, you'll be back there 24 hours from now, and I'll call you. So I was back with Mr. Mandela. Mickey called, and he said, yes, we'll do it, but Mr. Mandela cannot tell anybody, and we'll just do it. So I quickly wrote a note to the president not to fire the trade representative and that this was my doing, and I said, Nelson Mandela owes you a big one. So that's an example, and an American ambassador and the residence of the ambassador is not only represents the president, but the United States and all Americans.
Yeah. Tom Loftus, our guest today. Tom's book, which you're going to enjoy, A Mission to Oslo, and the subtitle, Dancing with the Queen, Deal-Making with the Russians, Shaping History. Questions or comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we talk about Norway in a couple of shows. A little later on at noon, we'll hear the continued story of Norwegian immigration to the U.S. and the impact Norwegians have had on our state's culture. Right now, Tom Loftus, a former U.S. ambassador to Norway, a Sun Prairie, Wisconsin native, is talking about his book, Mission to Oslo, a wonderful book about his time there. You know, I want to go back to, Tom, to the story of how Bill Clinton, President Clinton, selected you as ambassador. And then I certainly want to talk about preparations and the kids and the family and so forth. But what about that process about being selected?
Well, Larry, I was one of the very few speakers in legislatures in America that ever got involved in presidential primaries. And there's a reason for that. You pick a candidate and you make ingrates of the other people running. But I was always involved. I started with Morris Udall in the primary in Wisconsin and went through Mondale and was the chairman of the Dukakis for President campaign. And I was the top-ranking Democrat in the state at this time. And in 1992, I had come to know Bill Clinton and chaired his campaign in Wisconsin. And he won. It was a very difficult race because the Democrats are a party that whoever the nominee is going to be, we have a faction that doesn't want that nominee. But anyway, so we were close, and I was in the parking garage of the Milwaukee Area Technical School. This was one of the last campaign events. Clinton had a Harley Davidson jacket on. Their Harleys are made in Milwaukee. And I said to him, if you get elected president, I am going with you. And I didn't say I'd like to. I said I was. And that's how close we were. So February 1993, I'm in the Oval Office with the president, just the two of us. He's only been president for a month. And we say to each other, this is amazing that we're here in this office. This is amazing. And he said, well, here's where Nixon kept the secret tape recorder. Here's my desk. This is the Resolute desk, a gift from Queen Victoria. And I said to him, I want to be appointed ambassador to Norway. Well, he had been briefed that this was coming, and he said to me, you'd be good at that. Well, politicians, seasoned politicians, never want to say no, and they'd like to imply an answer that meant yes. Well, that wasn't a no, and weeks went by, and nothing happened. Well, one of the staff people that I knew went to look at my file and knew exactly what had happened. Clinton had wretched handwriting. And one staff person had read his note as no, a bad idea. But what he had written was not a bad idea. So my nomination went forward. And, the vetting, the State Department, then the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, four of us going to Europe, had our hearing. Herb Kohl introduced me, and we were reported out unanimously, and then nothing. And more weeks. And a senator, and senators can do this under their custom, was holding us four hostage. This senator wanted someone in the State Department fired. I had never heard of this senator, Mitch McConnell. Well, a deal was made. They weren't fired, but some deal was made. And so we off to Norway and off to our small three-story Art Nouveau villa sitting on its own city block.
It was quite an operation. And you had to, you and the wife and kids had to go through a little training, I would assume. And Norwegian isn't the easiest language to learn. You knew a little of it. I think wasn't your wife pretty fluent?
Well, after. This is after the fact, yeah. Well, the State Department allowed me to take my initial Norwegian lessons in Wisconsin rather than going to Washington and studying at the Language Institute. There is a Language Institute not only for State Department people, but also for the military, because the attachés around the world and others usually will learn the language. So my tutor was Lou Ann Sorensen, and she was a graduate student at the Scandinavian Studies Department at the UW. By the way, they're having their 150th anniversary. And Lou Ann said, you know, at age 48, you're not going to be very good at this at all, but we're going to work on your accent. And she was right. The most important thing is if you've got the right accent, so people understand you really made an effort, that will do you well. And then we had a tutor in the embassy itself for the staff. This was basically a consultant. And I had Norwegian lessons there. And it was mostly, he also said, you're not going to be very good speaking this language, but we're going to get you so you can read and you can do diplomatic talk. You can say the right things with the right accent. And I accomplished that. And I gave a 4th of July speech every year in Norwegian, practice it, as you can imagine. The tutor took out every word that I had trouble pronouncing, and we got it down to a point. And the first time I gave this speech, people came up afterwards. We didn't know you were fluent in Norwegian. So I got quite a reputation for that, but that's that story. I couldn't. When I go to Norway, it comes back, and when I'm here, I can read it, but that's about it. And learning a language at age 48 is not recommended, but I did my best.
Well, I think you did pretty darn well. I was taken by the you had a comment about the difference and the kids, your kids, and what was different about Norwegian schools compared to American schools.
Well, Norwegian schools are they start at a very early age, let's say 3 or 4, in what we would call a preschool. But there they call it a barnehagen. Barna is the word for children. Hagen is the word for garden. And these are sort of play, learn centers that are mostly outside, including in the winter. And at age 7, they start school, go to age 19. And the big difference is that last year is like the first year of college. The other difference is Norwegians are taught English as their other first language. It's not taught as a second language or a foreign language, because there's only 5 million people. They have to speak English in their daily lives, their studies, the textbooks, the thing. The third difference is the Lutheran Church was the state religion of Norway when I was there, headed by the king. The bishop and the pastors were government employees. The religious teaching takes place in the public schools, not in the churches. So it took me a while to really get my bearings as to my relationship with the official church. I got around it. I got to it, but that was quite different than me growing up a Lutheran at the Bristol Lutheran Church outside Sun Prairie, or on being baptized at the Liberty Lutheran Church in Deerfield. I could do a whole book on that subject alone, but that's the answer to your question.
And the kids had to learn to cross-country ski, of course.
Oh, God, yes. and I did. You know, I had my colleague in Finland, he had to take a nude saunas. all I had to do was go cross-country skiing, which was a social occasion. And my youngest son, Carl, he was 6 or 7 at this time. He was in school. And they took him away for a week to learn how to cross-country ski at a camp. This is what it was. Now, after the end of the Cold War, the NATO base in Oslo, which had 5,000 personnel, most of them administrative, closed. I closed it. And then an international school opened. The British school, the Pentagon school, the Department of Defense school, and a small international school merged. So the boys had that experience. And you had to have a language in that school, and it couldn't be Norwegian. Now, there were a lot of Norwegian students who had their own studies. So it had to be an international language. And that was a great experience, and has stood them well.
You mentioned in passing the residence, and there are so many other stories, and we'll get to them. But the residence itself, that was a site for meetings, but a lot of social occasions. So it was a large. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, it's a large house, 3.5 acres of gardens and a park. It sits on its own city block. It's a historic Art Nouveau style house. It was bought by the State Department in 1923 for $125,000, the best property the State Department owns in the world. And the reason the residents, we could sit 50 people for dinner. The secret are round tables, and taking out the furniture.
Yeah.
But, under the State Department metric, Oslo was the costliest city in the world to live. So my salary and others in the embassy were bumped up 35% to make it the difference. However, we couldn't entertain in restaurants or hire halls or do anything like that. It was just too expensive. So we did all of the entertaining and the meetings, mostly in the ambassador's residence. And, there were 3 maids, there was a chef, a gardener, a police, former policeman for security, my driver, and my car. Started out with an armored Cadillac, ended up with a black Impala V8 engine, cloth seats, no armor. All of that, plus the seating charts and everything, that's the canvas. It's as important as the canvas to an artist. This is where the work is done. You go there to be a professional friend, and it involves meals. And when people sit down with each other, you become acquaintances, then you become friends, and then former adversaries start to smile, and you can get some work done.
Yeah. It's a fantastically interesting story. Cheryl in Iron Ridge has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am 50% Norwegian. My grandmother and grandfather were from Oslo and Trondheim. And I also belong to the Sons of Norway. But the question I have for you is, I have always wanted to go there and see it. And I'm 72 now. And what would you recommend me to go see first, and how to see Norway first for my very first time to go there?
Well, first of all, I'm 80, so I don't think you're very old at all. Well, we had this question about every day of those 1,400 days. I had this question, my assistant really came up with a boilerplate thing, and it was called Norway in a Nutshell, that if you have a little time, you go to Oslo, you take the train to Flam, you take the ship on the famous Sognefjord, you go to Bergen, and then you can go on from there, or you fly back to Oslo. It's very easy. All Norwegians speak English. And if you smile at them, they'll smile at you. It doesn't work the other way. So I would consider that. And also these cruises that where your hotel room is your ship, those are very popular, and they're popular for a reason, because they organize the things that you should see, rather than you trying to do it yourself. That's my answer to that.
Cheryl, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I want to talk about Russia for a minute with you. It's hard to remember the state of Russia, the state that Russia was in when you were ambassador. And Norway was kind of key because, and for one thing, it's the only NATO member with a border with Russia. So you had a lot of focus on Russia.
I did. This period is the Cold War has ended. The Soviet Union has disappeared. Russia is a new and very shaky democracy headed by President Boris Yeltsin. The border with the Soviet Union and Norway is now a border with Russia and Norway. And Norway and the United States really need to use this entry point to build a new relationship with the new Russia. And why it is so important is that this part of Russia near at the city of Murmansk is the only ice-free port Russia has ever had on the Atlantic Ocean. So this is where all the nuclear-powered submarines are with their missiles in them aimed at the United States. And this is where all of the nuclear waste and used nuclear weapons are. This is also where the American submarines play cat and mouse with the Russian submarines under the polar ice cap. So my task was to form this new relationship with the Norwegians and partnership to build this new relationship with Russia, which meant cross-border trade and new customs and tourism and everything that you can imagine. So I'll just mention why. When Nazi Germany invaded Norway in a surprise invasion and the occupation followed, where Hitler had 350,000 troops in Norway, it was a very harsh occupation. Near the end of the war, the Soviet Red Army liberated North Norway from Nazi Germany, from the German soldiers. Well, instead of staying there, like the Soviet Union did in Eastern Europe, they just went back over the border and closed it, and it never opened for 50 years. And so I was one of the first to go over that border and went to Murmansk to deal with the Russian Northern Fleet officers and the head of the nuclear icebreaker fleet and we negotiated a deal on the safekeeping and secure storage of what is called low-level liquid radioactive waste. Larry, this is the liquid that cools reactors in a submarine, like a like in your car, mm-hmm. your radiator.
Yep.
And that becomes contaminated. The Russians were dumping it in the Arctic Ocean. So when I led this deal, it is a deal, that there would be safe storage of this and that there would be some U.S. help with the payments. And this was when there we had a deal with the Russians to help them deconstruct their nuclear weapons and safely secure the ones that were in outside of Russia proper. So that was a lot of trips to Russia, and it was the most important thing I did there. That is still ongoing. That was one thing that survived Putin so far.
So far. I remember you tell an interesting story about the new Russian ambassador visiting about the low-level nuclear waste into the Bering Sea.
Yeah. Well, I had, of course, you have to be friends.
Yeah.
And the new Russian, the Russian ambassador and I decided we were going to have lunch every month, just the two of us. His house one time, my house the next time. And we were going to tell each other things so there was no surprises. And I wasn't going to do something that would embarrass him in Russia, or he wasn't going to do something vice versa. And our first meeting was in my residence, that small house I described. And, you know, Russia was in tough shape at this point. They couldn't pay the sailors in the Northern Fleet. They were selling blood to get money. It was, the whole country was in very bad shape. The Russian embassy in Oslo, they could only fill their cars halfway up with gas before, you know, they waited for the next payment. Anyway, they survived. So we have this first lunch at my residence, and we really hit it off. And as we're leaving, I offhandedly say to him, "I suppose you have this place bugged." And he says, "Yes, but they don't work."
Oh, man.
It was his way of saying just everything has gone to pieces, including this.
Russia in a shambles. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Tom Loftus, our guest today, his book, a fascinating book, is titled Mission to Oslo, Dancing with the Queen, Deal-Making with the Russians, Shaping History. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tom Loftus, our guest today, former ambassador to Norway. We're talking about his book, Mission to Oslo. Very entertaining and interesting book. Esty in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Esty.
Hey, so I visited Norway twice. What a wonderful country, and did all kinds of amazing things, including crossing the Arctic Circle with the ceremony that goes with that, and sitting on the deck of a ferry on June 21st so that they could see the sun setting all the way and then coming right back up. And also visiting Kirkenes, which is on the border with Russia, and standing so close to the Russian soldiers, almost eye to eye, and being warned not to make another step because they would arrest us. But so that's just a few of many wonderful experiences. But I wanted to talk about two things that happened each in the one visit, but they are related in my mind. the first time I was traveling there with my mother, and we were visiting an old friend of hers in Oslo, and she took us all over the city and showed us and explained what we were seeing, and she took us to one of the neighborhoods that really didn't look different from any of the others, very wooded and nice and calm and clean. And she explained that this is a neighborhood where a lot of people who are addicted to drugs were living, that the government was providing them with small apartments, and there were clinics right there to exchange syringes and so on, and they were getting a small monthly
stipend. Stipend, I'll bet. Yeah. Well, Tom, a comment on that?
Yes. Norway, particularly Oslo, has had a terrific problem with heroin addiction, and not any more than any large city in America, to tell you the truth. But they had their treatment was to try to prevent the addicts from doing petty crime and other things in order to feed their habits. So there was this needle exchange, which was important because use a dirty needle and you end up with anything from HIV/AIDS to tuberculosis. So that's what he's referring to. Very popular are Nordic murder mysteries in Wisconsin, in the United States.
They are.
You'll find this theme in a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. Esty, thanks for those comments. Appreciate it. There were one story you tell illustrates the amount of planning and work that has to go into visits. And Hillary, who was the first lady at the time, came to the 1994 Olympics. And I was just struck at the amount of detail that has to go into planning for a visit from an important person.
Well, yes. Jimmy Carter came three times. I had the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One important visitor after another. But the Lillehammer Olympics, the First Lady came, and we were friends before this, and we didn't have much notice, as you'll see in the book. We were told 10 days before the Olympics that the First Lady and 800 of her closest media friends would be descending on us, and Chelsea Clinton, who was 12 at the time. Well, we found a hotel room. It was in a legal fight in Sweden between heirs as to the ownership, and it was empty. A miracle, basically. And I called the lawyers and made a deal. They couldn't refuse. And so we took over that hotel for the period of the Olympics. Those Olympics were magical. And we had Tommy Moe, the American, won the downhill gold medal. And Dave Jansen from West Dallas won the gold medal in the speed skating after he fell down the first time. It was so amazing, and there was a person in the official delegation. It was me, Hillary, and then four or five others that the president has chosen. And he was the editor or the publisher of the Nashville Banner, and his name was Kirby Simpson Jr. II. It was a name right out of Mark Twain. Anyway, we're there at the VIP bleachers sitting, and a whisper goes up in the crowd that there is the king. And there's quite an audible whisper. before I could do anything, Mr. Kirby Simpson Jr. the second bolts from his seat and goes up to the man and said, King, this is the most wonderful Olympics. This is terrific. You should be so proud of the organization. The people are so helpful. The wonderful. This is great. And the man said, well, thank you very much, but I'm the king of Spain.
There's one other story I want you to tell, and that has to do with Tommy Thompson. He calls you from Germany.
Well, Tommy Thompson and I had been friendly adversaries in the legislature for 14 years, and or no, more than that. And, you know, we had this brief period when, as he describes it, I ran against him for governor. I said, Tommy, no, I ran for governor. So we were friends and always had been. So he calls me, and again, my assistant says, you'll want to take this call. And he said, Tom, it's Tommy. I'm in Germany, and I got nothing to do here. I'm going to come up there, okay? I said, okay. By the time you get up here, I'll find something for you to do. Turns out there were four states that were being considered for a wood flooring factory, a Norwegian company. And so, okay, we had a dinner. We took out all the furniture. We invited the whole management and the CEO and the spouses of everybody of this company. And I served reindeer. This when you serve reindeer, it's a fillet. This is the most a delicacy. Then you know that the guest is important. The guests know the guest is important. Tommy, I think, didn't understand why we're eating reindeer. Anyway, so we come, the meal is great. I hired a piano player. I went all out for him. Anyway, at the end of the meal, the Norwegian custom is to give a thank you for the food speech. Duck for Matten, it's called. The dessert was already on the table. Tommy gets up to give this speech. It's not supposed to be a speech. It's supposed to be a thank you for the food. And he recognizes his best friend ever in the world, Tom Loftus. I said, I don't know about that. Anyway, then he talks about the business acumen of the head of this company, and then the vivacity of his vivaciousness of his wife, and everyone in the audience, and he's going on and on and on. Well, the ice cream had melted. Yeah, and he was still going on about Wisconsin. You know, it was like Athens in the age of Pericles. It was Valhalla. It was, you know, whatever. Well, it turned out the company settled on a location in Racine. So there you have it.
Oh, my goodness. I wish we had more time to talk, Tom. This has been such a delight, and I'm telling you, it was a delight to read your book. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for your service to Wisconsin and to the United States as well. And thanks for writing this book, and I hope a lot of people read it. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Larry.
Tom Loftus, his book, Mission to Oslo, and it's been chosen as one of three finalists for Best Memoir Autobiography of Midwest by Midwest Independent Publishers Association. So you're gonna have some fun reading it. We didn't get to even a 100th of the stories in his book. Well, we're going to continue our discussion about Norway, and that's coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.